มีความรู้สึกเป็นยังไงที่ท่านหลวงพ่อมีมาอยู่ที่นี
่ Nung was asking how you all feel now that Nung Po V has come back to live in this place.
We feel very fortunate to be in his presence.
Wow. รู้สึกมีความสุขและโชคดีครับรู้สึกว่ามีหลวงพ่อวี came back to take care of his mother here in Ottawa but he'd also already been traveling in other places and gathered a lot of knowledge and so he brought that knowledge back to this place even though coming back here he came back as a monk he still very much appreciated his debt of gratitude to his mother and all the support that she'd given to him in the past and so when the appropriate time came he was more than happy to support herAnd as we also know from the suttas, then Sariputta, who was the Buddha's foremost disciple, also, as he came towards the end of his own life, went back to see his mother out of a sense of respect for all that she had done for him. But that's because of understanding the goodness that person has done for us and wanting to pay that debt of gratitude back. So it's good that Bhavi has come back to this place because he can...pass on the knowledge that he's learned and also help to communicate a sense of the importance that we also each understand that those teachings and apply them in our lives as well. And now he's back in his hometown, even though earlier he was involved in establishing a monastery in New Zealand. Because of the very aged condition of his mother, then he...made the decision to come back and take care of her out of an expression of his understanding of all the good things that she'd done for him. And then it's beneficial for you because as he gives the teachings, then in applying them you can compare them to your own feelings and your own disposition and then make the adaptations that you need to in your life in order to come in line with the teachings.That involves developing an understanding of your own heart and its potential to know its a good side and bad side and develop accordingly. So then for all of us coming to this place and interested in the teachings, then we all have something in common. We're all experiencing the same human condition. We all have similar human bodies built up out of material elements.And in a sense, you can say that we're all relatives in our life and death in this world. Living close to the Sangha is good not just from the aspect of listening to the teachings, but also because one can observe and see the way that the Sangha live and just learn and observe from seeing the way the Sangha practice, including the way that the senior monk practices.Then what your teacher's giving you is not something material, but he's giving you that which provides the opportunity for you to make the change within yourselves. And what he's giving you is guidelines and principles for your practice. And then so we really are in a similar situation, each of us, because we have the same experience of happiness, we have the same experience of unhappiness, and we understand that... Our job is to clean up that which we find, which is dirty. Then in the course of our practice, then we adapt our hearts, understanding that when the work of the mind is the important thing and that the teacher will emphasize the nama dhamma or the immaterial aspect, which we call the mind. And then knowing that when the mind is good, then everything seems good and we feel happy. And when the mind's not good,that we experience difficulties. In that sense, then that's where we apply our practice to make the heart better. And in doing that, then our lives become free and easy. In the course of our practice, we do need to rely on certain qualities. And it's those qualities that we have that will benefit us in our practice. And just the same way as our sense organs work. The eye sees forms, but in order to be able to see, then we need light. And so in the same way, for our mind and our mindfulness, to understand things, then we need that those dhammas which are a great support, which is mindfulness and clear comprehension. And so because of the importance of this mental aspect and the importance of the quality of the faculty of mindfulness, then that's why we come together to train in our mindfulness, because that mindfulness is what provides immunity to our mind, in just the same way that our bodies, if our body have immunity, then we'll be much less likely to get sick. But our heart can also get sick, which is why we need to have mindfulness watching over the mind. If mindfulness is weak, then we fall prey to the niwaranas, the hindrances, or the obstacles. Yeah, those mental obstacles of desire, ill will, drowsiness, restlessness, and doubt. If our mind is watching over, then that's how we avoid these problems, which are like the unease of the mind, which is very similar to the disease of the body. If we have a fever in our body, then we need to treat it. So in just the same way, we also need to manage our mind, and so it's mindfulness then that will show us how to manage our mind. And so then when mindfulness indicates to us we need to manage our mind in this way or that way, then it's then up to us to practice in that way accordingly. What we may understand then is that we need to develop good qualities which will make for good states of mind, beginning with the practice of dana or generosity. And so on. So with generosity, morality, and so on, then we're paving a way for a greater sense of ease of mind and a smoother path for our practice. The practice of dana, that is an act of sacrifice, which is a necessary beginning step for our practice and the basis for our practice. And actually, it's a very good quality. It's the highest of qualities to be one who's willing to make sacrifice. In this way, with mindfulness and an attitude of sacrifice, then we can observe the nature of our own mind, and we're also aware of the danger. We see the danger of all the unwholesome mind states, and therefore we endeavour to put our mind into a mode of relaxing, letting go of self-importance. And we do that by gradually accepting the truth of the Dhamma. For example, we've had the misconception for a long time, and all of us take the same idea that the body is who we are. But the Buddha said that the body is not who we are. So then do we believe him? And if this body is not ours, then who does it belong to? The Buddha said that it just belongs to nature. And we can see this is true because we're not fully in control of anything which belongs to nature. Because nature in turn is controlled by the three characteristics of impermanence and suffering and not self. And so that we can observe right throughout nature, that when things arise, then they exist for some time and pass away. And so seeing this and understanding this in all things in the world, then we can reduce our wrong view. If we see all that arises as just nature, then that will help us to relax, and we won't take anything as us or belonging to us, and we see things according to the truth or the true Dhamma. And in that way we can see the body just as a body. And as for the worldly Dhammas, they apply to the aspect of the Nama Dhamma, or the immaterial aspect of our lives, the mind. Feelings of praise and blame, gain and loss, and then fame, disrepute, and happiness and suffering are all ways that we respond to the input of the world and then feel delighted or disappointed. So we're placed within society as humans. We're societal beings. We have our parents or we have our children, and as such we know the role that we need to play in order to be responsible within the family. But if we just follow our feelings and react to everything, then we'll become a victim to the worldly dhammas. When we're blamed, for example, and told that we're not good, then we'll take offense at that and feel that we have to defend ourselves. Actually, probably we don't need to fight. We could just say, if we're told that we're not good, well, after all, this body and life, maybe it's not so good. It does have a use-by date, after all. And I was reminded of that going into Ottawa yesterday. Lumpur V drove us into the city, and along the way I saw many graveyards. It's just every one of those graveyards is a reminder that we all have to die, and that there's nothing really substantial or lasting in this world, and also nothing certain in this world. So then seeing that and being reminded of that, it's a reminder to put down our grasping and clinging, put down our upadana, especially the atavad upadana, the form of upadana or clinging and grasping to the atta, the self, the idea of a self. Also kama upadana, attachment to sensual pleasures. Sometimes when we see rich people and compare them to poor people, we think of how well off the rich people must be. But then if we were to look from a different perspective, maybe we might see that it's not such good fortune to be a rich person, because when one has a lot of material things, then one's prone to become obsessed with those things and become a slave to infatuation and wrong view. And then when one has so many material things, one's just tied down by them all. One becomes a slave to them all. And in the end, they're nothing but a cause for worry. Then we see the benefit of making sacrifice and in giving offerings. It changes our attitude towards material objects. And we see the danger in attachment to material things. And therefore we aim to put down our attachment to material things. Because we see that all those physical things have just come into being in the world due to causes, they're conditioned things, and therefore they can't last. And also with mindfulness we see all the immaterial things as they come to arise in the mind, they're also conditioned things, and they also can't arise. Those conditioned things of the mind are called mental sankharas, and they are generally divided into two types. There's the punyapi sankhara, which is the wholesome or meritorious mental condition. And then there's the apunyapi sankhara, which is the unmeritorious mental condition, or good thoughts and bad thoughts arising in the mind. And we see that even though there is the wholesome and unwholesome, that both of them belong to the realm of the worldling or worldly being or patuchana. But this is our aim, to learn about this, to learn to understand the nama dhammas. And the Buddha said that we should study right here and recognize that there are two extremes that we should not avoid. As going into the extremes of pleasure or displeasure, because both can be equally harmful. Then we'll see within our heart that aspect of pleasant feeling or satisfaction of the heart, which is in fact just as dangerous as that unpleasant feeling or the dissatisfaction of the heart. And we just recognize it as what it is, in just the same way as we see the body just as the body. We're teaching ourselves to recognize the danger in both attaching to satisfaction and dissatisfaction. We're gaining a feeling of dispassion towards all things, that everything having arisen must cease. And we can observe that process of things arising and ceasing. We can see that where one thing ceases, there another thing arises. And we gradually understand that there's no us in any of that. And as we see that, then we realize the danger of attaching to samsara, this round of things which come into being and then cease to be. The more that we understand this, then the higher our heart, the higher our heart becomes. It lifts our heart up to a higher state of understanding. And then, surprisingly enough, learning to understand all the things in the world as impermanent is not a cause for worry, but actually it rests our mind, it causes us to put things down and not to stress about things, knowing that happiness and suffering, neither of them are who we are, and nor do they belong to us. But they're just covering over the real truth. And therefore we put down all those conditioned things, understanding that just as suffering arises, exists, and passes away, happiness is just another form which arises, exists, and passes away. If we can observe this for a long time, then that gives to a feeling of power and energy. It's the energy of putting forth effort continually, maintaining mindfulness continually, and consistently, so that no mental state can overcome us. And then we just see all of those mental states also as just mental objects, just the world going through its changes. And we don't give too much importance to those, but we give importance to our mindfulness as we continue developing mindfulness, no matter where we are. Wherever we go, we rely on material supports, and through mindfulness we can know the right amount in all that we use. That, meaning that mindfulness knows how to relate to all material things. And in that same way, when mindfulness is well established, we can observe, know and understand all that we do in all the postures of the body. And we'll see all of this as just natural and ordinary, and there's nothing that can give rise to worries. The name of this practice is the Bodhipakkhya Dhammas. That's the Dhammas that lead to awakening or to enlightenment or seeing according to the truth. When Lumpovi invited Lumpo to come and give this session, he said that he would invite him to come and answer questions, which and the word in Thai for questions and problems is the same word. And so then Lumpo said, well, you know, if we have any problems, it's only because of not being familiar with what we're doing. So he's giving advice so that we can all become more familiar and better understand what we're doing. That's the way it is with familiarity. When we don't yet have the experience, then we don't yet know how things really are. Just like different parts of the world, if we haven't travelled to a certain place yet, and we're told about certain country or people that live in that country, then we've got to work with is our imagination. And so we develop a picture or understanding of that country's like this or like that, and the people are like this or like that. But then it's only until we actually go there that we see it's not really the way we thought it was. So it's just through familiarity that we can understand things. And then all of you have got a good intention and making an effort to practice. And then so with that effort you'll be able to build up your energy. You'll have the power of faith, or Sattapala. And that's the power of faith in the Triple Gem. The Triple Gem is not a material thing. Even though we have a Buddha Rupa or a Buddha image, it's just an expression. It's just meant to... it's just there in order to bring up feelings of respect and inspiration so that we can have the faith that actually the change can occur within ourselves and recognize that where there's something dirty, then that thing can be purified. Just the same way as if there's dirty and impure water, then it can be made into clean water, even drinkable water, if it goes through the right processes of purification on the coarse level with filtration and then with chemical treatment and so on. And so that we can see that the place that cleanliness actually comes from is just from the dirt. And it just comes according to the right causes. In the same way that a child, if well supported, well fed, well looked after, will grow up into a strong human being. Also, the Buddha, who's within us, if well supported, will also arise there within us. And that what that means is that right view arises within us, the view of seeing things correctly according to nature, see things as they are and see them just as normal, and feel well adjusted according to all things, and have a kind of happiness that's not shaken by the world. Being one that relates to everything in the world in a heedful way, not being negligent. Because through our practice, first of all, we've established cleanliness in our heart, and that's led to peacefulness which then allows the natural radiance of the heart to be released. With our initial practice, we paved the way by cleaning up our conduct, and then we've experienced peacefulness, a calm state of mind which is able to accept everything in the world the way it is, and that's all empowered by mindfulness. It's the true radiance of the heart, radiant with mindfulness and with wisdom. When we see things clearly with mindfulness, then we see things as they really are. And this process the Buddha described as the building up power and energy, also known as the five powers of Sattā, or faith, Wīrya, effort, Sati, mindfulness, Samādhi, concentration, and Paññā, wisdom. It's a group of five, and it looks like the Buddha is talking about five different things. But if we understand how that the faith can cause the right practice to arise within us, then we see that actually they're all perhaps the same and all contained within the one. Do you have any questions for Lopo?
I had two questions written.
Mm-hmm.
So the one question I had is that, can you speak about desire for material objects, which you talked about?
Oh.
And then I had this word when practicing the middle path. The other one was about anything about reflections on the Dhamma, depending on the time of death. If you're conscious at that time, whether you can offer any reflections for that.
And that's your question regarding desire. Actually, desire is a natural instinct, and it's a very much a primal and natural instinct that all creatures have, because they need to go out and seek support for their material bodies in terms of food and so on. So desire is something which rouses us to action, to go out and seek something, and that's actually a natural instinct. And one thing is that we just shouldn't assume that when we feel that we need something, we go out to get it, that getting that thing will necessarily provide us with real fulfillment. But on the other hand, this kind of seeking out support for the material body isn't something which we should be afraid of either, because you can't really say it's incorrect desire. It's only there for the purpose of supporting the body. But the kind of desire which is really wrong is the desire which goes for the purpose of harm, either harming oneself or harming others. So in terms of ordinary desire for the right amount of food at the right time and so on, or taking care of the body, then that's just doing one's job. It's just like the Sangha have their kichavatas or regular jobs, like taking care of the dwellings and so on. And all of us have regular jobs and chores in our life that we have to do, because we need to take care of those things which we need to support us. It's not so wrong. But then the key point is that the kind of desire which we need to watch out for is the desire which isn't for things which we need or which support us or which are appropriate, but are for things which will harm us or others. And as for the second question about death, then that's something which is also just a matter of duty. It's nature doing its duty. And so then I wouldn't advise you to do much, because there's not much you can do. Nature's just come to do its job. So then what I would advise you to do is to let go and to understand that this is the normal, the end of a long chain of all the organs and the processes of the body doing their job. And when they were doing their job, we couldn't control them too much. And then when they finally come to the end of the line and they're packing in, then we can't prevent it. But what we can do is just to put down the burden and accept that death is coming in the kind of overt or obvious form of death, the very open form of death. But actually, we've experienced death every day in the kind of hidden form of death. And that happens every day. with everything that we do and experience, and all the smaller parts of our body are always having come into being, they're always passing on. And the process of aging and decay and decline has been happening for many years now. So it's just finally that at this moment it's come to time where we really should put the burden down, really should let go. We should recognize that all the organs of the body are just doing their job, and we can see them and understand them as they are and know the truth of them, and then experience that the body will close down in this way. When the physical burden gets heavier and heavier and it's just too much, then at that time, that's when we should just let go. And when we let go of the bodily elements and see them go according to their nature, then that's when we can really see that they're not us or ours. And then we can really see not self, see anatta dhamma just the way it is. So then seeing things that it's not self as anatta, then that's the dhamma of upekkha or equanimity. It's also known as ekagata, or the mind becoming one-pointed. And understanding things as just natural and normal. And then understanding that within nature, which is natural and normal, there's nothing to gain and nothing to lose. So, now we was speaking about having visited people when they're close to death, or even at the moment of death. And he's observed the process happening and says nothing too unusual or strange about it. It seems very normal and natural. First of all, when he's getting close to death, about 10 minutes away from death, then the consciousness will start shutting down. So then the eyes, which could previously see, then they don't do the job anymore. And ears, which could previously hear, they can't hear anymore. And also then the mind also shuts down, and that the consciousness being aware and thinking also shuts down. And then one by one the bodily functions will cease, and the breath stops, the heartbeat stops, and everything stops. The reason the Buddha taught about all of this is so that we wouldn't get into worries or agitation about these matters. And he gave us so many teachings that describe this principle, and saying that there'll be separation from all those things which we love and which are dear to us. And just the way that when we come together for a meeting or a gathering, then eventually that gathering will break up. All things that have a beginning will also come to an end. And the Buddha was continually giving us this information, so that we could reflect on it and relate it to our lives and see that it's normal and that there's nothing to worry about. And then the final piece of advice that the Buddha gave, when he was coming to the end of his own life, was that we should be diligent in our practice and do our job without heedfulness, because then really nothing lasts. And with that sense of diligence, then we won't fall prey to any unwholesome states of mind, and we won't be set aback by any changing conditions of nature. One example of the Buddha's teachings about impermanence and separation and the truth of nature is the Abhinnavatthavekana, or five subjects of frequent recollection. Firstly, that we all are subject to aging, and why did the Buddha teach that and remind us of that simple and ordinary truth of aging? It's because we're all prone to intoxication and forgetfulness and just indulging in life. And so the Buddha went on to teaching about pain and suffering, that we're all subject to sickness, and then also that we're all subject to decay and decline, we're all subject to death. And he also said that all subject to separation. There'll be separation from all that we know and love, and that's just normal. And the Buddha taught all this so that we wouldn't fall prey to ignorance, avijja, because to fall prey to ignorance or avijja is to fall prey
to tanha or craving, and that also answers another question, because the Buddha said that the Buddha, when speaking of craving, he gave a very short definition of nibbana, and when asked that question, the Buddha said that nibbana is simply the ending of craving. So then this is all this points to the truth of that our lives end in death, and that you can say that it's a signal from the Lord of Death, or a signal from the guardians of the afterworld, or call it what you like, but it's simply signals from nature that all beings age and die, and there are even little folk rhymes about it, and then of course told one of the Northeastern Thai rhymes, which is having been tall, you'd be short. What was black would be white, and so on like that. It's just that's a speaking about that the changes in their body when they become very old. Having been short, tall, you become short, and their hair having been black would be white, their skin having been clear becomes. It becomes wrinkled and blotched. So this is just a kind of a very simple truth of nature, and the reason the Buddha always kept pointing us back to it is just so that we can undo feelings of difficulty with that, and undo our own feelings of self-importance. This is in fact a very important meditation object called Maranasati. And Maranasati is for the purpose of fighting against delusion and fighting against delusions of self-importance. And this is a battle that Siddhartha, having left the palace, fought himself when he was sitting under the Bodhi tree for enlightenment, and you can see that in a particular kind of Buddha image which they call Vikriya Anumara, where the Buddha is sitting with one hand in his lap and the other in the right hand on the top of his knee, and it's called Vikriya Anumara. And the story about this Buddha Rupa is that when the Buddha sat down and was putting forth effort for Nibbana under the Bodhi tree, that memories of his previous life in the palace arose, and that his previous life in the palace was very comfortable, and he was respected wherever he wanted as a young prince, and so the more he thought about that and remembered that as he sat there, then the less and less energy that he had for putting forth effort striving for enlightenment. But he didn't give up. He remembered a certain concept, and that is that any kind of work or any kind of effort which one begins and doesn't finish is not then auspicious, and it's not beneficial anymore. But it turns out into something bad. And so he asked himself then, if I go back then to the palace, will anyone respect me? Or will they think that I'm someone who just can't achieve that which he sets out to do? And so in that sense, then he decided to stay. And that's why the images like that, because he made up his mind to remain sitting under the Bodhi tree, and he held himself down, held himself in place, and literally held his own knee down from rising up. And so he told himself, no need to get up, even if you die. And so, as you know, the Bodhisattva made the determination under the Bodhi tree that even if his bones and even if his flesh and sinews would dry up and there's nothing but the bones, then you would not get up until he achieved enlightenment. And otherwise he would die. And so he then took death as his object and practiced Maranasati, reflected on death, and then said that if I die right here, then the earth is ready, waiting to accept my body. And then this changed the way he changed the way he felt. This feeling of acceptance helped him to see death in the normal and ordinary context in which it actually is. Then, should his body die, actually there's nothing to it. Then dying, then what's left? Is it he saw that there's nothing left, and no need for any body, no need for any delusion of a self, and understood that state of emptiness, and saw that there's no being and no self or person in there, and then realized that that death is just nature doing its job, and then he came to peace. Probably enough for the afternoon session, and many questions are answered. We can close the